Hi guys, and a happy Monday. Today I'm so excited to be sharing an episode with you with Dr. Sarah Church, who's the founder and executive director of Whole View Wellness. And I mean, she just has a ton of expertise in the substance use field. And given that April is Alcohol Awareness Month, which was something that recently came to my attention, I think this was just an amazing opportunity to get some of the many questions that I had about alcohol and sobriety, and just kind of like going off of last week's episode where I just pulled from a bunch of facts that I had learned and getting more clarification on them of like, was this right? But because there's still so many questions I had about things like, is alcoholism even like a real thing? And is it possible to be a moderate drinker? And in this conversation, Dr. Church was really able to provide some context and answer many of my questions. So I think you will all really enjoy it. And one thing I'll say too is I think just kind of looking back on all the episodes I've recorded that specifically touch on sobriety have been with people who are kind of like me and very in the all or nothing mentality of like, if you're going to, you know, cut back from drinking, just cut back altogether. And I think that Dr. Church was really able to provide a more nuanced perspective and looking at like the dialectic of it's not all or nothing. Like, moderate drinking is possible. Is it the easiest route to go down? Probably not. But her team at Whole View Wellness certainly offers that as an alternative to just cutting and going cold turkey. So for anyone who has decided to reevaluate their relationship with alcohol or learn more about how to do so, I highly recommend listening to this episode. And yeah, without further ado, here is Dr. Church. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Solace in the City. Today, I'm so excited to be here with Dr. Sarah Church. Dr. Church is the founder and executive director of Whole View Wellness, an innovative outpatient addiction treatment center that uses state-of-the-art science-based techniques, technology, and expertly trained clinicians to provide patients with the highest quality therapeutic experience in addiction treatment. Dr. Church is a clinical psychologist with more than 20 years of experience in research, program development, and treatment of patients with substance use and co-occurring mental health disorders. Dr. Church, thank you so much for being here, and I'm so honored to talk to you, especially given that April is Alcohol Awareness Month, which I learned recently, and it seems very well timed. So I'm really excited to talk to you.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Of course. So I was wondering if you could just start off by telling me a little bit about yourself. Where are you from? Where'd you grow up? Where'd you go to school? What's your story?
Sure. So I grew up in Westchester County, about an hour north of the city in Bedford. I went to school at Columbia in the city for undergraduate. And then I went to Fordham for my PhD. And then I did an internship at Yale in the School of Medicine for a year in addiction. And that's sort of where I sort of found my passion for working with people with alcohol and substance use disorders.
That's awesome. And go Lions. Yeah. That I now learn is the mascot of Columbia. So speaking of, you know, how you got interested in learning more about addiction through that internship. I mean, I feel like, at least for me, going into social work and wanting to become a therapist was definitely, it's a weird term, but almost like a selfish decision because I wanted to learn more about myself and just given my history of my own mental health conditions and, you know, losing loved ones to suicide and just wanting to give back. That's, really wanted to get some answers and learn more about myself. So I'm curious, what drove you to the field of psychology? Was that what you studied as an undergraduate? Was it like, were you driven to the field due to like personal reasons or just, what kind of incited that?
So I think that in reflecting on my career and looking backwards, I have more of a sense of what happened than I did like as I was living it and as I was moving through it. But in retrospect and in reflecting on things, you know, I look back and I realized that my own experience in psychotherapy as an adolescent, I went to therapy when I was, I think, 15 for a couple of years. And I really enjoyed that experience and felt like I'd learned and grown so much. And I wanted to do that with other people and for other people. And so that's why I had the idea of going into psychology. And I did study psychology undergraduate. But in terms of focusing on the addiction field, that wasn't something that, like, I did, I think, with the knowledge that I was understanding myself better as I was moving forward and through it. But I realized after I had started doing this work and found it so interesting and I felt so passionate about it, maybe years into it, in retrospect, I realized that I really was dealing with some of the things that my family had experienced or some of my family members had been through, including my father and my uncle, my aunt, like a lot of family members struggled with some kind of alcohol or substance use disorder. And I think, you know, I think we're all drawn to things that have something that resonate for us in various ways.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And it's so interesting because I think specifically, especially learning more about alcohol, I'd say it's one of those things of like, once you see it, you can't unsee it. Mm-hmm. At least in that, that's how I've felt. For, you know, for my decision to stop drinking was started out as a dry January, then it would be a year. But then as I started learning more, it was like, oh wow, I had no idea that all these other factors were contributing to what I thought was a fault myself, as opposed to just a nature of what I was drinking. And so I think that sense of like gaining clarity on the root cause of a problem can be so empowering because it makes you realize that, you know, the decision isn't completely out of your control. You have some, especially for someone like me who is very control focused, you know, it's really reassuring to hear that or learn that, you know, some of these things are based on the substance itself and the society's attitude around addiction, as opposed to, you know, it's my fault because I got addicted and I couldn't stop and I didn't see the signs and, you know, the self-blame that comes with something like that.
I think what you did was really smart, like the dry January. And of course, that's much more popular than it ever has been. But taking a little bit of time away from drinking helps you clarify how much of what's going on for me is my drinking, how much is other things, you know, and it really gives you a lot more information that you can sort of use to make decisions going forward.
Yeah, absolutely. So for some context, ever since I stopped drinking in, I want to say, you know, roughly like 110 days ago, or I don't know.
Amazing. Congratulations.
Something like that. Thank you. I've been learning so much just through books I've read and interviews I've conducted with people who are alcohol free or completely sober. And it's both taught me more about like the nature of alcohol as a substance, as well as how and why our society kind of like glorifies it as some miracle juice. And in doing so, I've learned a lot, but I feel like the more you learn, the more questions you have. And so there were certain things that I wanted to get a more like scientific perspective on. And so I was hoping you could help me out with that, just given your, you know, plethora of research in the field and work that you've done and program development, et cetera.
Yeah. I mean, tell me a little bit more. Like, I'm not sure exactly, like, in terms of the science behind why someone is drawn to alcohol or what are you struggling with?
Well, certain different things. So I guess to give some background, I recently recorded an episode where I shared 20 things I've learned about alcohol since I stopped drinking. And one of the topics I focused on was just the concept of alcoholism and whether or not there is truly such a thing as an alcoholic. Specifically, you know, I talked about how Alcoholics Anonymous is founded upon like the disease model of alcoholics, which states that problem drinking is sometimes caused by a disease in the brain characterized by altered brain structure and function. And, you know, according to this disease theory, genes play a strong role in the development of alcoholism. However, in reading Holly Whitaker's Quit Like a Woman and some other books, to my best knowledge, the disease theory of alcoholism has not been completely scientifically proven, or at least there's like limited research on if there is a specific gene that causes alcoholism. So I'm not a doctor or scientist.
Okay. So I guess where I land on that is what we know from the research is that someone having an alcohol or substance use disorder is about what leads to that is about 50% environmental and 50% genetic. Mm-hmm. So there's both environmental and genetic factors that play into whether someone struggles with alcohol use. What I learned actually just recently, Hank Kranzler, he's a researcher at in UPenn, and I believe, and he wrote a paper recently that talked about how alcohol use disorder is polygenic, which means that whether you have a problem with alcohol use or not, there are many genes that go into that. Mm-hmm. And what he said was, and it was shocking to me, was that the number of genes that play into alcohol use disorder is about the same number of genes as height, like how tall or short you are. And he said there's like 11,000 genes.
Wow.
Yeah. So it was really sort of mind-blowing for me to think this through. So there are so many factors that play into genetically whether you have whether you're drawn to drinking. Or drink in a problematic way. And then there's also environmental things. So that's why I believe that we see a real spectrum of drinking, from people who don't like to drink at all, to people who drink, but they're really not drawn to it, to people who drink in a heavy way, to a risky way, and then some people, every time they have a drink, go off on several days of drinking and then they can't stop and they need detox. So it's really a whole spectrum. And I think it's because there's so many factors that play into it.
Yeah, that makes so much sense. And I think that's kind of where I have an issue with the word alcohol, like an alcoholic, for example, because mm-hmm. it's basically a blanket term for such a nuanced problem, as you said. You know, if there's 11,000 genes and I have 50% of those or something, when I stopped drinking, I'm very fortunate that I didn't have any withdrawal symptoms. I've not attended an AA meeting. I've done it relatively, it's been a relatively easy thing for me. And so although I definitely had a problem with drinking, I don't know if I would consider myself an alcoholic. Not to say that there's any shame around that term, but it's unfortunately just our society does have a stigma around alcoholism and alcoholics, because they associate it with a person on the street who's drinking beer out of a brown bag and all of that.
The way I think about that is really, I encourage people not to worry about the labels or the terms. If they don't, some people like that term and it helps them, and some people really don't. Mm-hmm. And either one is fine with me. I mean, what I really encourage people to do is to think about, how are you feeling and how are you functioning? And is alcohol getting in the way of how you're feeling? Is alcohol getting in the way of how you're functioning? And if it's getting in the way, then we might want to take a moment to decide whether reducing your alcohol use or stopping alcohol use is going to make you feel better or function better.
Yeah, that makes total sense. And it kind of is in line with like the second of these questions that I had, which is in regard to the notion of a quote unquote addictive personality. So for some background, I recently interviewed Annie Grace, who's the author of a book called This Naked Mind. And we talked a lot about the concept of an addictive personality, because despite never really labeling myself as an alcoholic, I definitely, when I started or stopped drinking, referred to myself as having an addictive personality. For example, I've battled an eating disorder in the past. I had obsessive compulsive disorder when I was a child. Just all of the plethora of the poo, or what does Brene Brown say? Like the poo-poo platter of mental health conditions. And then when I spoke to Annie Grace, she said, like she had a real problem with that term, because there's no such thing as an addictive personality. And in fact, some of the factors that contribute to becoming addicted to something are actually qualities that make people leaders and CEOs mm-hmm. and highly successful, like, you know, being outgoing, being an extrovert, trying new things, just to name a few, which makes sense if you think about all of the celebrities who don't drink or had some sort of problem with substance uses, because not only are they successful in their careers as singers or actors or comedians, but, you know, those same qualities led them to the bottle. And so mm-hmm. I was wondering if you happen to have any additional information on, like, the science, if any, that there exists behind the term addictive personality.
Interesting. I don't know of any science behind that. I think that's more of like a lay term that people use. Mm-hmm. I mean, to me, when I hear that, I think, you know, some people are more drawn to some things than others, right?
Yeah.
Like if we talk about alcohol, when we drink alcohol, when anyone drinks alcohol, they release endorphins and enkelfins, which are sort of like the opiates that we produce in our own bodies, and they feel good, right? You have yeah. that initial rush. And I think that some people, you know, and it's probably all genetic, right? Some of those genes that we were talking about before, some people produce a stronger endorphin rush or a stronger enkelfin rush when they drink. And so it just feels better to them. So they're more drawn to it and they want to do it more than other people who don't have that rush of endorphins that is released when they drink. You know, and I just think we're all different biologically and we're different environmentally. You know, like some people who don't have a lot of reinforcement in their life, maybe they don't have a lot of people in their life, they don't have something that's meaningful in terms of a job, those kinds of things. When they use cocaine, they're really, it feels so good. It feels so much better than how they feel normally. They're just more drawn to it because they don't have the environmental balances that yeah. keep them from wanting to go for that, you know? And so I think it's so complicated that there's, I don't think there's one personality that draws people to be drawn to alcohol or drug use or something like that. I think it's a combination of genetic and environmental issues that come together and access, you know, yeah. if you have no access to alcohol or drugs, then maybe you never try them. But if it's around you or it's in your neighborhood or it's easy, you have easy access, then that's another environmental, you know, reason why some people are more likely to end up using.
Yeah, that makes so much sense. And it's interesting because I think if I look at the people who I've had on this podcast who are now sober and suffered with some sort of, you know, quote unquote addiction to alcohol, I'd say they're all very similar to me, very outgoing, extroverted, mm-hmm. used to be like life of the party, honestly, still life of the party. My sister always would say, Zoe, you're the last person on earth who needs to be drinking because you're already kind of crazy. And, you know, and I'm the like, I'll jump on a table and dance even if I'm dead sober. So, and I think a lot of people I've had on the podcast have been similar in that way, which mm-hmm. greatly contrasts with the I don't know if it's like a preconception that people have, or at least I had, that, you know, people who become addicted are those, you know, who have social anxiety or, you know, revert to alcohol because they don't want to be social and it was a way for them to loosen up or like have that mm-hmm. liquid courage mm-hmm. or, you know, drinking alone. Like it contrasted with a lot of beliefs that I used to have. Mm-hmm. And I, now that I think about it, I don't think it's like one or the other. I think, again, it's just so nuanced. Yeah. It's both. It can be either depending on your personality. And at the end of the day, alcohol is an addictive substance. Like, that's probably the most important fact.
Right. It's really reinforcing. It feels good when people drink. So there's so many reasons why people drink, right? Like, some people drink to reduce anxiety. Some people drink to reduce depression. They feel like it's going to help with the depression. Some people drink just to make a good time feel better, you know? Mm-hmm. But then there's also the biological piece of who gets drawn to have the next drink, and the next drink. And some people are just more drawn to it than other people are.
Yeah. And I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but the statistics I've been throwing out are that alcohol is like the second most addictive drug after heroin. Is that true? Because I've been throwing that around a lot because it was mind blowing.
You know, that's interesting. I don't know exactly. I mean, I think that nicotine is also very, very addictive. But heroin, alcohol, and nicotine, I think, are the probably your top three.
Yeah, which is wild though, because I think on the list, cocaine is like number 16, and you wouldn't just call someone who goes, who only uses cocaine on the weekends, like a moderate cocaine user. Like, it's there's just, I think
I'm not sure how they come up with that list.
yeah, that too. But it's just like, you see like heroin, you're like, how can this be in the same category as alcohol? And at the end of the day, it's because alcohol just becomes so socially accepted, and it's really the only drug that you only are considered to have a problem once you stop using it, which is just a fact that I learned, or something that again, it's like one of those things that you can't unsee it or unhear it, because it just makes me think of like, why is that? Like, who's benefiting? And ultimately, it's the big alcohol companies and the marketing companies and these people making us think that it's our choice, but really they're removing that choice from us altogether, and they're just using it, what is it called? It's like controlled controversy, and like, or something like that, or controlled, I'm forgetting the term, but it's so fascinating. So my next question, is, I'm sure it'll be like a little bit nuanced as well, just given, the complicated nature of all of this. It is, so for example, when I first started reevaluating my relationship with alcohol, which was like 3 years ago or so, I started to like cut back on drinking. So by restricting myself. So for example, I would hold myself to only drinking on the weekends, or, not imbibing any hard liquor, or limiting the number of drinks I would have when I would go out, et cetera. But the more I think about this, and the more I learn about the addictive nature of alcohol, I'm starting to think that moderate drinking isn't really possible, especially for those who have that genetic predisposition to becoming addicted to alcohol. So I was wondering, given the research that you've done into all of this, do you think it's possible to moderate your alcohol consumption?
Yeah, so I guess I have a couple thoughts on a lot of thoughts on this.
Okay.
At WholeView, we have two different tracks. So when we do an assessment of someone when they come in for treatment with us, we evaluate them and we say basically, what's your goal? And some people will come in with a goal of trying to reduce or moderate their drinking or some substance use, and other people will come in saying, I have to stop. This is not for me. Please help me stop. And either one, we'll say, great, okay, so that's your goal. Let's talk it through. We put together a plan. So some people will come in with a goal of moderate. Many people come in with a goal of moderation. They don't really want to stop altogether. They want to try to drink like a gentleman, or drink less, or drink, in different ways. And so we'll create a plan around that, and an ideal use plan. How many days a week do you not want to drink at all? How many drinks do you want to, ideally, how many drinks do you want to have? What's the outer limit that you want to have? What would it look like if you pass that? What is your worry? We sort of go through that whole process. What I'll say is, moderation is much, 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 much more difficult
Yep.
than abstinence. So people who choose moderation are going to have to work a lot harder, typically. I think it is possible for some people to moderate, but people sort of, what we find is that people sometimes will start with a moderation goal, will try and try and try, and maybe they're successful 85% or 90% of the time. Sometimes they decide that 10% of the time is just not worth it, and
Yeah.
they may eventually choose abstinence. But it sometimes it takes time to sort of look at the data to honestly evaluate, like, what is the effect of the alcohol they're taking in having on their life and their relationships and their work. And we sort of, if we can look at that really honestly, then people make, I think, good decisions for themselves. And so the answer is yes, I definitely have worked with people who have been able to moderate. But it's hard, and it takes vigilance over time. The easiest route is abstinence, but not everybody wants that. So we're
Yeah.
willing to work with people, and to sort it out. And some people will start with abstinence for a period of time, and then want to try a period of controlled drinking or moderate drinking, and we'll do that too. And then sometimes they'll try it, and then there'll be some episodes where they overdrink, or there's something happens, and then they go back to abstinence. So We see everything, I guess is the answer.
I love that you offer those both of those approaches, because I think, you know, it is, I think that, like, as with many things, like the hardest part is just saying, like, I'm giving up this completely. And it's a lot easier conceptually to think, oh, cutting back will be easier. But mm-hmm. as you said, and as I've learned, that's not necessarily the case. So it's cool to hear that based on your experience, you've seen that, like, A, that's true. It is a lot easier just to cut back entirely, but you also give people the opportunity to try moderating and see if that lifestyle works for them, because I think the all or nothing mentality prevents people from even considering cutting back. Because it's like, well, if I'm not going to do it successfully, like, might as well just go all out and, you know, if I have to choose, I'm going to choose the path of least resistance.
And for people that choose moderation, we usually encourage a period of what we call sobriety sampling, which is like dry January.
Yeah.
You know, if we can get them to agree to a 90-day period of sobriety sampling, that's sort of ideal, because we want them to have a really nice opportunity to see, what is my life like without drinking? How does it feel? How's my sleep? What does my skin look like? Mm-hmm. How's my relationship? How's work? Like, to look at all the different aspects of their life when you remove alcohol for a period of time, comparing that with, say, the 90 days before they come in to meet with us, you know, and mm-hmm. what's the difference? Like, how does it feel? You know, how, you know, what are people giving you any feedback on what's different in life? And we sort of look at that sober period, the sobriety sampling versus the previous. And we do a lot of really intense, like, sort of analyzing, like, the differences so that they know.
I love that. Yeah, I love that concept or term, sobriety sampling, because one problem that I see with dry January, although, like, I've attempted it a couple times and I've seen people do it, is February 1st, it's like celebration of that it's over. And I'm like, that's kind of defeats the purpose. Like, the purpose of this is to learn more about yourself and, like, maybe reevaluate your relationship with alcohol. It's not to just, it's not like Lent, you know, it's not to deprive yourself of something and then have, like, you know, or like have a fat Tuesday before and then go all out once it's over. So right. I like the idea of really mindfully keeping track of, you know, as you said, like, how does my skin look for me? Better, like, so much better. How am I feeling? Like, less bloated. I could, again, name a million things.
Some people lose weight. Some people have more money. I mean, in New York City, going out and drinking is expensive.
Yeah, I remember, I mean, before I quit drinking, I went to this one bar, and, like, again, I currently live in Austin, where you can get a drink for like $7. And then I went to this bar with a friend and I ordered like a vodka soda and like a gin and tonic or something, like the most, like, basic, you know, rail drinks. And they give me the check and it's like $50. Cause I was like, oh, I got it. I'm like, do you want to pay for this actually? So yeah, definitely saving money. And I guess my last question, and I'm not sure this could be a stretch, but it's something I think a lot about just because of my history with an eating disorder and this one podcast I listened to a while back that I found really fascinating. And it was basically about, it was a podcast from, what is it called? The Human Brain by NPR. And they talked about, like, I forget what it was called, like a scarcity mindset, but it was talking a lot about how when you deprive yourself from something, you focus more on it. It's like the tunnel vision. And so, for example, they talked about those with eating disorders and how, you know, when you're not feeding yourself, your mind is constantly thinking only about food. So, mm-hmm. like, I know from personal experience that when I was in the depths of my eating disorder, I would, like, look at food menus as, like, almost a way to nourish myself, which is really weird to say, but... And I almost think that if you look at that kind of moderation component, I see a lot of similarities where if you're constantly thinking about, oh, I can only have one drink, your mind is still thinking, like, drink, drink, drink. Like, you, it's almost like it reinforces it. So
yeah, that's really interesting. I never thought about it that way. I do see often for people who, and you mentioned that early on in this journey, that you would say, I'm only going to drink on the weekend. Sometimes when people restrict all week long, then their drinking actually gets heavier on the weekends. Like I've seen that. It's sort of a, and I think if you're doing sort of a eating disorders metaphor, if you're restricting food for a period of time, sometimes people binge eat and then purge. So with drinking, I have seen that happen sometimes where people restrict for a period of time and then they binge on alcohol. And that becomes a different pattern and problematic in a different way that we have to sort of address.
Yeah. It makes a lot of sense. Like, even if it's not scientifically proven, I think it's, again, something important to keep in mind. And like, if you know, someone is trying to cut back, thinking like, how much more am I thinking about alcohol now that I've cut back? Mm-hmm. And just, again, like holding oneself accountable.
Yeah. The other thing that happens with folks that I'm working with who are moderating is sometimes they just get like overwhelmed. Or not really, I would say frustrated with having to think about it all the time. It's a battle that they're working. Like I said, I was only going to have two and now I want the third. And, you know, now I'm only going to have the two and sort of like having that battle, or they go and have the third and then they're beating themselves up about it. And then, you know, they feel like they have, even though they only had three, they still feel like they've lost that battle. And, you know, so there's a fatigue that comes along with the moderation process for people who are struggling to stay drinking in a moderate way. Sometimes people just don't want to deal with that struggle anymore. And they may choose abstinence as a result of that, or they may choose to drink, mm-hmm. you know, but more often than not, I think people end up, when they're working hard at it and making decisions around it, they choose abstinence.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. So the last kind of clarifying question I had is, and I have it bullet pointed as like chicken and the egg. So when I first stopped drinking, I was under the assumption that alcohol was kind of adding to, but not causing my anxiety and depression. So for some background, so that you have a little bit of a knowledge on my, again, poo-poo platter of problems. I've, you know, dealt with anxiety for as long as I can remember, you know, ups and downs, depression. And specifically when I'd say all of last fall. So maybe like, or maybe the 6 months prior to January, I had been in a pretty deep funk, just with a lot of different reasons, basically with friendships and, just feeling like, oh no, I'm in the depths of depression again. And I'd actually met with my doctor in December to discuss, you know, potentially upping my SSRIs and or trying a new additional medication. And then I stopped drinking, and it was like my mental health improved so drastically that it made me think like, oh my gosh, has alcohol been, is it the chicken or the egg? Like, what was, did my depression develop because I was drinking, or was I going to the bottle because I was depressed, or is it both? Is it neither? So I guess just like based on your experience, how many of your clients do you see like having an experience similar to mine versus, I know there's the other metaphor of like, once you stop drinking, you have to deal with all of your battles and like confront them head on. So I guess if you could talk a little bit about that, that would be so helpful.
Yeah. I think it's, again, I think the reason why I love doing this work is it's so complicated. There's so many different ways that it presents. So I see both things happening. So a lot of people feel a lot less anxious. They don't really, in their mind, they think about the relief they have for that 30 minutes after they've had their first or second drink. They feel good for a little while, but what they don't really focus on is the next day when they're feeling so anxious and so wound up and so guilty and so frustrated, you know, and upset with themselves and angry. What we work on in therapy is sort of looking at both sides of that and realizing that alcohol has both effects. You know, when you're first drinking, you feel less anxious, but when you're hungover or when, you know, the next day, you feel really bad. And sort of remembering that alcohol is, you know, involved in both of those feelings. And oftentimes the anxiety or the next day is far worse than the good feeling that they had initially in the night. So sort of like looking at that. So there's that side of it, but then there's also You know, for people who have been drinking steadily for a period of time, after they go through detox and or you know, after they stop drinking, they're feeling a lot of feelings that they haven't felt in a long time. And so they have to learn how to tolerate those feelings, how to move through those feelings without drinking. You know, and that's a different kind of work.
Yeah, Glennon Doyle calls it sitting on the mat. Like, you just have to sit on the mat and just push through. Like, if you were doing yoga, you know, like, it's a lot of pain. You're doing all these different positions, but you have to do them on your own. And I feel really fortunate that because of the years and years of therapy I've done and the money I spent on it, a lot of those demons were already dealt with. And so it was like, I don't know. It was like alcohol was almost like this, I'm trying to think of like some weird metaphor, but like it was the last thing that I had to conquer in order to fully like reach my quote unquote potential, which sounds super cheesy. And I kind of hate myself for saying that, but it does feel like, holy shit, I feel like a new person, even though just months ago I was out feeling the same things that I've dealt with for the past, I don't even know, 7-8 years.
Yeah. I mean, and having this period of sobriety, like, is giving you that clarity.
Yep, exactly. And just being able to reevaluate relationships and friendships and decisions. And luckily, a lot of those have already, like, I'm glad that actually, that's a lie. I'm going through a lot of change with moving back to New York and all these things. But I do think that the sobriety has given me clarity of, like, this is the right move. This is the right decision. Rather than going back and forth and then just getting up in a, you know, a mindset of, oh my gosh, like everything's like, and then just, you know, becoming so anxious and depressed that I don't want to make any of the decisions. So all to say is I've had a very positive experience with sobriety. But kind of going off of that, so ever since I've stopped drinking, I've become that stereotypical sober person who can't stop talking about, you know, how amazing sobriety is and listing all the terrible things about alcohol. And I have to kind of stop myself from being like, did you know that alcohol is the second most addictive drug after heroin? So I guess my question for you is, how can we balance educating those around us about the dangers of alcohol without coming across as like annoying or judgy? Or, you know, we want the best for people, but we also don't want to piss them off.
Right. Well, I think what you're doing with the podcast is a great way to do it, because people could come to you and listen to your podcast if they're interested, right? Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's just balancing, like, whether someone's interested or not interested in hearing about it. Like, I think there are so many people out there who want to hear what you're talking about. Like, they want to hear what are other people's experiences of not drinking. That's why I think, you know, so many times on podcasts now, also on Medium, on so many different blogging, blog posts, and even on like Instagram and other Twitter and other places, people are talking about their experiences because people want to hear.
Yeah.
What was it like for you when you didn't drink for 90 days or 100 days? Or, you know, they want to think, oh, would those experiences be true for me if I stopped drinking? And so I think it's really important to talk about. I think it's great that you're doing the podcast. That's why I was so happy to join you. We actually even have a group at Holby. We call it #AltSober. Because it used to be that people really only talked about these things in the rooms in AA, right?
Yeah.
In church basements and places like that, which is great. I think that's wonderful. I think people should definitely continue doing that. But it's really nice that people have alternative ways of talking about this stuff now, like podcasts and blogs and things like that. It just puts it out into the community so people can choose to participate and listen, or they don't have to, you know?
Yeah. Have you heard the term sober curious?
Sure.
I'm wondering, because based on like the number of people I've talked to, you know, all the TikToks I've seen and just books I've read, and it's like, I think we're on like the precipice of sobriety becoming more mainstream. And there's like this TikTok I'm thinking of. It's like, is alcohol the new cigarette? You know, of like, are people going to start almost being radically sober as opposed to being felt like they're pulled into, you know, the drinking culture? And so I'm wondering, just because, you know, you run this center that offers both treatments to help people completely stay away from alcohol or moderate their drinking. Have you seen an increase in people coming to your treatment center because of this newfound, like, almost like interest in sobriety?
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't know. I'm not sure if we see more people, but we definitely hear people talking about this idea of sober curious, or, you know, there's sober October, there's dry January, there's mocktails in every restaurant you go to these days, there's zero proof drinks, you know? So I do think that it's much more in the popular culture to choose not to drink. There's also the other thing that I really found just recently, like in the last year or so, is that people are monitoring their sleep. They've got like a Fitbit or a watch or like some kind of sleep monitor, and people are noticing significant reduction in the quality and amount of sleep they get when they're drinking before they go to bed. And people don't like that. And they really want to, people really want their sleep and they want to protect that. And a lot of people are not drinking because of the effect it has on their sleep.
That's interesting. Yeah. I mean, I don't have any of those, but it's interesting to hear that people like are prioritizing their sleep so much that that's kind of the impetus to them wanting to cut out drinking. I'm like, I don't know if I'm sleeping better. I always just sleep a lot, but hopefully that's a good thing. Hopefully it's good quality too. And so one of my last questions is, what are some warning signs to look out for that may indicate that you or a loved one or a friend might have an unhealthy relationship with alcohol? And kind of the follow-up to that would be, how would you go about that conversation without it being like a full-on intervention?
Yeah. So one of the things that we also do at Holview is a therapy called CRAFT, Community Reinforcement and Family Training. So this is a therapy for the loved ones of someone who's struggling with alcohol or drug use. So we treat not only people who are struggling with alcohol or drugs, but the family members or the loved ones. And sometimes we have people who come in who have a family member who has no interest in stopping, and we work with the loved one. It all goes back to how people are feeling and functioning. You know, are they functioning well? Are they not functioning well? Do they have health challenges because of their drinking or their use? You know, are there, you know, mood fluctuations like irritability and anger that seem to be connected to, you know, either using or the after effects of using? So just sort of, you know, looking at the person holistically, and are they happy and healthy, or are they struggling in some way? Mm-hmm. You know, and when we talk to people about their use, you want to talk to them in a really caring way. Like, I really care about you and love you so much, and I'm wondering if you think maybe your drinking is getting in the way of you getting to work sometimes, or getting your schoolwork done, or maybe you're smoking weed and it's causing problems, you know, with school or work or something, you know, or we have arguments every time you're drinking, or, you know, whatever the thing is. And I really want to be there for you. I want to help you with this. Is there anything you think I might be able to do to help? Or, you know, sort of just asking them if they're ready to make a change, and do they want to talk to somebody about it, you know?
Yeah.
You know, and then helping them get to the right place, you know, if they're ready to talk about it.
Yeah, it's definitely like you can take a horse to water, but you can't make them drink, kind of a thing. But I think, yeah, as you said, like coming from a place of empathy and concern and like
compassion.
Love and compassion is like the utmost or most important thing to get them there. Because it is, as with like a lot of topics related to mental health, it is a touchy subject.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think trying to get it out there as a topic that is okay to talk about is helpful. But if you like, in talking about it, one of the things we teach is positive communication skills and techniques. So you want to talk about it in a way that's positive, that's compassionate. And so finding ways to bring up your concern, but bringing it up in a way that's supportive.
Yeah. I think that's one thing I heard a lot from a few of my guests, as well as like, I tried to do when I did this like episode on 20 things, three things I learned, because I think hearing the positives is a lot more conducive to change than hearing the negatives. So hearing like, my skin has gotten so much better, I'm less bloated, I have so much more time, things like that will be more helpful than like, oh, if you, like you're getting too drunk, like your hangovers are bad, like you yell when you're intoxicated or something like that. And so just because I think ultimately people deep down want what's like, they do want the best for themselves. And so hearing how their life could be better, who knows, like might inspire them to make the change on their own.
Yeah, might motivate them.
Mm-hmm. Solace in the City is sponsored by BetterHelp. If you know me, you know that I have seen plenty of therapists in my day. And I will tell you, as much as I, you know, love meeting with each therapist, it was not an easy road to find them. And if you're, you know, in the process of searching for a therapist, I'm sure you know that it's quite expensive. I actually have been recently looking for a therapist who is licensed in both Texas and New York, and the average cost of ones that I come across are around $275 out of pocket for just one session, which is wild. So in the past, I have been using BetterHelp and I am obsessed with my therapist. She is amazing and has helped me through so many tough times. And I am paying a fraction of the cost of what I was paying when I was meeting with someone directly. You can choose from thousands of therapists from their network. And one of the parts that I like the best, and I guess this is maybe, you know, me being a people pleaser, but breaking up with therapists or meeting with someone and not getting along right away is kind of not fun. And then it's like, it makes you not really want to continue, you know, the search. But with BetterHelp, you can easily switch therapists and find someone who you click with, and then you can meet with them at your own convenience. So I found it extremely helpful. And if you choose to, you know, check this out or give it a try, you can use my code to get 10% off your first month of therapy, which is big because it's already pretty cheap. So if you just go to betterhelp.com/Zoe, that's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Zoe, Z-O-E, you'll get 10% off your first month. Give it a shot. And if you find your therapist soulmate, let me know. So I always wrap up with a couple of questions somewhat related to this podcast, somewhat completely unrelated. But the first one is, what is one thing in your life that's happened to you that's made you a stronger person today?
Wow, that's an interesting question. That's tough. You know, so when, I'm struggling with this.
It's okay, you can take your time.
Yeah. And I think growing up in a family where there were issues around drinking definitely helped me find this path, this passion, this work that I'm doing. Maybe that's one thing. You know, sort of in retrospect, having lived with someone who had struggled with alcohol use disorder, and I had family members with opioid use disorder, having those experiences, I think, definitely made me more compassionate, more able to empathize and understand and help the people that I work with. So maybe that's one thing, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Because you can have the empathy portion as opposed to just like a clinical perspective. There's also the like kind of knowing what that person is going through and like knowing it's not their fault, knowing that there's other factors.
Yeah.
My next question is, do you believe everything happens for a reason?
Don't, but what I would say is that I think that everything that happens, you can make meaning out of the things that have happened.
Yeah, that's what I would probably say as well. I get very polarizing answers. It's either a complete yes or a complete no. It's really funny, depending on the person. Next question is, do you have a favorite quote or a mantra that you live by?
That's an interesting question. I think the thing that I often tell myself that helps me get through is like, I'm going to figure this out.
Yeah.
you know. But on the mantra question, I something that I actually do with a lot of my patients is that I help them figure out their own personal mantra, you know, in terms of their substance use. And I think it's very helpful. And I think it's why a lot of people really like AA, because AA has a lot of like mantras that they share with people that, you know, they kind of give you like one day to live it one day at a time, or do the next right thing, or those kinds of mantras that have a lot of wisdom, and they're very pithy and they're very succinct. And I think having mantras are very helpful because it's the kind of thing that you can always come back to, and that that keep you on track in a way. So I think that mantras are really helpful.
Yeah, it's funny. It makes me think. I just watched the latest Ted Lasso. I don't know if you've watched Ted Lasso, but at the end, Ted Lasso or Jason Sudeikis like starts repeating to himself like, everything is okay, everything is okay, everything is okay. And then he gives this amazing speech, and I'm just like crying in my bed watching this episode, texting my parents.
I had a session this morning with a patient who told me just about that episode.
I think it's going to go down in history as like one of the best cinematic moments of all time, because the speech he gave at the end was like incredible, like just so good. So that's real. I'm not surprised. I feel like a lot of people are gonna like, I'm gonna definitely replay that whenever I'm feeling sad. I love that show.
Yeah,
that's a little off topic. Next question is, what is one what do you love most about yourself?
I feel like I'm a very persistent person. You know, I feel like I, you know, once I have a goal in mind, like to create WholeView or to create this program, like I am not going to be dismayed. I'm going to figure it out. That's, you know, back to my mantra, I'll figure that out, you know. So I'm very persistent. And, you know, even in creating WholeView, we have a group psychotherapy practice, which is like sort of concierge private practice. We opened up a program for people who might not be able to get this kind of treatment, which is we take Medicaid.
Oh, amazing.
And so like that has been a really big project with a lot of things to figure out. But I feel really proud that we've been able to provide care to people who might not otherwise get it in this really nuanced way.
Yeah, that's amazing. And I learning more like through my social work program, I know that there are a lot of hurdles to jump. So congratulations on doing that, because I'm sure it was not easy.
Yeah, thank you.
I'm curious, when is your birthday?
My birthday is July 26th.
Leo?
Leo.
Okay, that's cool. I'm a Leo moon, so I like astrology just to have fun with things. So that makes sense. And I think lines are persistent, I imagine. So kind of just having that fiery energy.
Go Lions.
Yeah, exactly. It lines up. My last question, which is the name of the podcast, is how do you find solace in the city? So New York, I was just there a couple of days ago. You know, it's a lot going on. It's easy to lose your cool and be stressed. But like, what keeps you sane?
Yeah. A couple things. I mean, I walk my dog. I do a long dog walk every morning, which I think is really important to me. Just get out, get moving, and spend some time with him. And I also do a lot of meditation myself. I find it really, really helpful.
Yeah.
So like if I get to meditate every day, that's usually the best 10 minutes of my day, 10, 15 minutes.
That's the next thing I need to do. I keep thinking like the two things that I never hear anyone complain about are sobriety and meditation. And I've yet to tackle the second, because I'm a Virgo and it is very hard for me to just leave my thoughts at bay and focus on mindfulness. So that's next, again, thing to tackle. Dr. Church, thank you so much for coming on this podcast. Where can everyone learn about WholeView Wellness, learn more about you? Plug everything.
Well, a couple things. I also want to just say, like, the other thing you had asked me earlier, like, is there some way that people can figure out, like, if there's an issue with their drinking? There's a website called myrelationshipwithalcohol.com. Which is a really nice website that people can check out. Like if they're not sure if there's an issue with their drinking, that's one way to check it out. So I would recommend that website. You can also, if you're ready to make a change, we would be happy to talk to anybody who wants to make a change with their drinking. We do like a free 15-minute consult, so people can call up and just pick our brains and ask questions. Whole View, it's www.wholeview.co, which is like Whole Foods, but Whole View. So you can go to our website, and our phone number's on there. And also there's a form you can fill out if you want to contact us through the form. But definitely what I would recommend, if people are thinking like, maybe this is a problem, or maybe I should make a change, I would recommend people don't wait. Don't wait until it becomes a bigger problem. Like, tackle it today. You don't have to wait till you hit bottom. That's sort of something that I really don't believe in. Like, it's sort of like saying, if you had diabetes, waiting till you have an amputation. Like, why would you wait? Like, tackle that problem today and start talking about it and see if you can make a change.
Yeah, because they're all like, there is no such thing as rock bottom, because it keeps going down and down and down. Like, you know, the next, just like wait until the next worst thing. So I completely agree. But again, thank you so much for coming on this podcast. I'll include all that information in my show notes. And yeah, have a great day, everyone.